Well, I recently came across some statistics about pastors. Found these quite interesting, quite sobering, actually. I was with one of our grads in New Zealand who's been pastoring for the last couple of years, and almost a little bit discouraged that we'd encourage people to go into ministry after these. But here's some of the statistics. Every month, 1,500 pastors leave the ministry permanently in the U.S., every month, 1,500. 80% of pastors and 85% of their spouses feel discouraged in their roles. 80% of pastors are discouraged, 85% of their spouses. 70% of pastors do not have a close friend, confidant, or mentor.
That's important.
Yeah, 70%. Over 50% of pastors are so discouraged they'd leave the ministry, but they feel that they don't have another way of making an income. 50, yeah. Over 50% of pastors' wives, this is the one that hit me the hardest, over 50% of pastors' wives feel that their husbands entering ministry was the most destructive thing that ever happened to their family. Over 50%. 30% of pastors said that they'd had either an ongoing affair or a one-time sexual encounter with someone in their congregation. 30%.
30%?
And only 1 out of 10 ministers will retire as a minister. So those are, you know, I don't know how accurate they are. Statistics are, you know, sometimes not accurate. But that's from a book titled Replenish by Lance Witt. Looked like a good book, but he's just talking about the need that we have to replenish our souls. But as somebody that trains people to go into ministry, you know, that's kind of a gutting set of statistics to think through. You know, and when somebody leaves a ministry, when somebody fails in ministry, you know, whose fault is it? And that there's a variety of possibilities, and maybe fault isn't quite the right word. Maybe it's who shares some of the blame for what's happening. You know, for somebody that's training people for ministry, you know, I think, well, you know, what could we have done in helping people to develop better? You know, could we have trained them, given them more tools, helped them to connect with God more, supported them more after they left the college, those types of things. And we're constantly asking ourselves that, you know, how can we improve our program? How can we improve what we do? Sometimes it's probably the church that shares some of the blame for what happens. A lot of toxic churches around the place. You ought to have a warning label on the front sign of the church, you know, little skull and crossbones down in the corner. Enter at your own risk. Yeah, that's right. The pastor's office. You know, so it could be that. You know, some churches put unrealistic expectations on ministers. We've talked about that, and that not only is on the minister, but the wife and the kids as well. Some churches don't put adequate support structures in place and expect the pastor to be Superman and then don't really support them. Some churches expect their ministers to live on salaries that nobody in the church would live on, because after all, you're serving the Lord. And many Christians can be critical and downright nasty and all of that. So it could be the church's fault, or it even could be that the pastor himself has contributed to what's happened. And it could be that those of us in ministry need to take a good long look in the mirror and ask ourselves some hard questions. You know, what I did wasn't wise. The way I handled that was arrogant. Maybe I was lazy. Maybe even I sinned. You know, and the reason that these things are happening to me is that I've done some things that I shouldn't have done. And as I thought about this, I think that probably the word that kind of sums up a lot of what I see in churches today is frustration. Pastors are frustrated with congregations. Congregations are frustrated with pastors. Just
a lot of people frustrated with God.
Yeah, people frustrated with God. And as I thought about the scripture passage that we're going to look at today, which is Numbers 20, probably the same thing is at work there. The people are frustrated with their leader is frustrated with the people, and bad stuff happens. So Israel's been in the wilderness. They've been in the wilderness for 40 years. They're in between that former undesirable life, which was slavery in Egypt, but they're not yet in the promised land with all of the hope that God has for them. And things obviously didn't go real well for Israel in the wilderness. And if you just back up a little bit from chapter 20 in Numbers, chapters 13 and 14, the people failed. So they had this tremendous opportunity to step out in faith and to follow God and to go into the promised land, to trust Him. And at the critical moment, they faltered in unbelief. And God said, "Not one of the men who saw my glory and the miraculous signs I performed in Egypt and in the desert, but who disobeyed me and tested me 10 times, not one of them will see the land I promised on oath to their forefathers. No one who treated me with contempt will ever see it." So the people in general fail in chapters 13 and 14. And then we come along to chapter 16, and the key leaders end up failing as well. You've got this Levite named Korah, and people who are following him. You've got three main leaders from the tribe of Reuben and 250 other community leaders that oppose Moses and Aaron. And then God responded to that by an earthquake that opened up the ground and swallowed the people from the tribe of Reuben, closed up on them again. And then when the sons of Korah and the other community leaders are there with their pans and their incense and their burning fire before the Lord, lightning strikes them and turns them into smoking piles of ashes. And then if that wasn't enough, the next day all the people start complaining again and God strikes 15,000 of them dead. So we've got the people have failed, we've got most of the leaders have failed, and there's a lot of frustration in the wilderness. And that's really the lead up to what I want to look at in Numbers 20 this morning. The setting is pretty important to this story. There's three details that I want to highlight. The first is the geographical location. In the first month, the whole Israelite community arrived at the desert of Zin and they stayed at Kadesh. So they stayed at this place called Kadesh. And that's really a very significant name, and it's going to be part of the clue of understanding what's going on in this passage, is Kadesh means holy. So that they're staying at this place, this holy place in the wilderness. And that's all I'll say about that now. For now, but just kind of tuck that away in your mind. We'll come back to it later. The second detail is the second half of that verse. There Miriam died and was buried. So you've got Miriam, who is Moses' sister, dying. Miriam has committed sin as a leader as well, and she's been punished by God earlier in Numbers. She challenged Moses, and God struck her with leprosy, and she was healed of that. And the interesting thing is, the end of chapter 20 of Numbers, somebody else dies, and that's Aaron. So this chapter is bookended by deaths of two of the key leaders of the nation of Israel during the exile, Miriam and Aaron. And then you've got this story in the middle between these two. So you've got key leaders, the top leaders who have been flawed and who are dying at the end in this chapter. And then the third detail is the lack of water. Verse 2. Now there was no water for the community, and the people gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron. This isn't the first time this has happened. Israelites continually found themselves needing water in the wilderness, which is understandable because you're in the wilderness. There's no water in the wilderness. You've got several hundred thousand families of people. You've got all of their livestock. They come to a place in Exodus 15, and the only thing that's there is bitter water. And so God shows Moses something to do. He throws a tree in the water, and the water becomes pure and drinkable. They move on to chapter 17, and there's no water, and so God tells Moses to go out and to strike the rock, and water flows out, and the people and their livestock drink. And now here we are again in Numbers 20, and the people are complaining once again because there's no water. Now, I think it's easy for us to be a little bit hard on the nation of Israel. You know, most of us on Sunday morning, we're sitting in a heated or an air-conditioned room on a nice soft seat, usually. There's water in the foyer. A lot of churches today have coffee machines in there. We've got all of the mod cons and everything. And so it's kind of hard for us to relate to Israel in the wilderness. But imagine if you came to church on Sunday and the heating isn't working on a nice cold day up in the hills. You don't have any water. There's no coffee. You come to church and the PowerPoint doesn't work. The electric guitars don't work, you know, because there's no power. Just imagine the grumbling that would go on from a few dozen people if something like that happened. But think about then several hundred thousand families in the wilderness year after year after year, and there's no water.
What's now Jordan, it's rocks and sand.
That's right.
And there's a little town that's got, it's like a little oasis. But I can't imagine all those people sort of even surviving on that little area.
Yeah, that's right. So we're probably a little bit hard on the Israelites, really, I think, because it is a significant, it's water. And we just turn on the tap and water flows out. And sometimes circumstances, sorry?
Except last night when the...
Oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah, it is kind of funny, isn't it? There's a YouTube clip. I can't remember the guy's name. It's Louis something. He's a comedian. Sorry? No, he's not a Christian guy. It's really quite an amazing little monologue he does with Conan, the late night guy. And the title of it is "Everything's Amazing, No One's Happy." Yeah. It's just from a non-Christian guy, it's an amazing thing. He just talks about being on the plane, and they had this service in the first class that they announced and said, you know, you can do this thing. It's some kind of computer gaming thing, and then they came by and they said, well, sorry, it's not working, and the guy next to him said, this is blankety blank. And he says, what? I mean, you're sitting in a chair in the sky. He said, you didn't know this thing existed half an hour ago. And he said, you know, you're flying from New York to Los Angeles in 5 hours. He said, that used to take 30 years. And when they got there, it was a whole new group of people than the people who had left. And so, you know, it's an amazing thing from a non-Christian comedian to tell us. But that's the idea.
There's videos of first world people have written down their complaints, their worries, and this filmmaker has got two-thirds world people to read out these complaints. Oh. It's so arresting. It's frivol, really. Huh.
Is that on YouTube as well? Yeah. Yeah.
Just third world people reading first world complaints.
Yeah, that sounds excellent. Yeah. Well, sometimes all of these things come together, they conspire together to frustrate us. This was the case for Israel in the wilderness. It's the case for us a lot of times. Our desires go unmet. Other things like tiredness, poor health, the weather, negative history with certain individuals, all of these things come together, and we become uncomfortable, we become annoyed, maybe we get frightened, maybe we get frustrated, and the question is, how do we respond to that? How did Israel respond to this situation in the wilderness at this place called Holy? Verse 2 again. Now there was no water for the community and the people gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron. That last phrase, they gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron, it's actually occurred a couple times before in Numbers, twice in chapter 16. First in verse 3 when the leaders challenged Moses and Aaron, and then again in 42 when they grumbled because God had put to death these people before the Lord. And they say in verse 3, they quarreled with Moses and said, "If only we had died when our brothers fell dead before the Lord. Why did you bring the Lord's community into this desert that we and our livestock should die here?" That's pretty amazing. You know, if you really hear what they're saying, when the earth opened up and swallowed up those people and closed in on them and crushed them and smothered them, we wish we had been among that group of people. When lightning came down out of the sky and fried those people before the Lord, boy, if only we had been in that group of people. Yeah, if only we'd have been that light. I mean, is it really? Is that really the way that you feel? They continue. Verse 5, "Why did you bring us out of Egypt to this terrible place? It has no grain or figs, grapevines or pomegranate." I don't know how they came up with this list. Pomegranates probably wouldn't be in my list of five things that I was missing from from the grocery store.
I heard about that from the promised land.
Well, yeah, hang on to that. And there's no water to drink. The people were not only frustrated, they were actually very forgetful. They forgot what life in Egypt was really like. Somehow, they had forgotten that they were slaves. Exodus said that the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly, made their lives bitter with hard labor. They had groaned in their slavery. They cried out to God for help. And in the wilderness, their memories had become just a little bit foggy. And there's several places, I thought we might even run through these, several places where Israel constantly is wanting to go back to Egypt. Chapter 14, verse 11 of Exodus. This is at the Red Sea, when it looks like Pharaoh's going to come and wipe them all out. Verse 11, they said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt?" That's probably ironic, knowing what we know about the Egyptians. "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, 'Leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians'? Would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert." Chapter 16, just two chapters later. The people didn't have any food. Verse 3, the Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you've brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death." Chapter 11 of Numbers. So after that complaint, God sent the manna. And now we go into Numbers. By this time, they've gotten sick of the manna. Even though every day they'd go out and God had rained down this food upon the ground. Chapter 11, verse 4. The rabble with them began to crave other food, and again the Israelites started wailing and said, "If only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost. Also the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. And now we've lost our appetite. We never see anything but this manna." And then chapter 14, when the people were afraid to go into the promised land. Chapter 14, verse 1. That night all the people of the community raised their voices and wept aloud. All the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron. And the whole assembly said to them, "If only we had died in Egypt or in this desert. Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt?" And they said to each other, "We should choose a leader and go back to Egypt." Now, why had Egypt become so attractive all of a sudden? Didn't have to rely on God? I think fundamentally one of the reasons is because it wasn't where they were right now. They were in the wilderness. They were in the desert. But God had brought them into the wilderness in order to teach them some things, to train them. And from this vantage point in the wilderness, Egypt looked a lot better than it ever had been before. So they were forgetful about the past. They were also forgetful about all of the things that God had done for them. Things like the plagues against the Egyptian. Things like food in the desert. Things like water in the desert. And it's really kind of hard to understand that again and again and again and again, they just keep forgetting all that God had done for them. Another thing that they hadn't forgotten is it wasn't Moses' fault that they were in the desert. It wasn't God's fault that they were in the desert with no grain or figs or vines or pomegranates or no water to drink. If you go back to Numbers 13, the spies, when they came back from spying out the land, they brought this big cluster of grapes on a pole that they carried between them, and they brought back pomegranates. I think that's why he mentions pomegranates, because there were pomegranates in the land. There were vineyards in the land. But they, through their unbelief and disobedience, had chosen not to go into the land. So they forgot whose fault it was that they were there. And I wonder how we tend to respond to frustrating situations, if maybe we're all that different, really. Right. People in the churches get frustrated. The pastor didn't come to visit me. Pastor's sermons are long, boring, and negative. Pastor never seems to listen to my concerns. Maybe it's time we ran this guy out of town. Pastors get frustrated. Leaders get frustrated. And there's so much unhealthy tradition in this church that I just can't seem to work through. What can we do to change things? How can we get people to start thinking spiritually about issues? When are people ever going to start giving their money to the Lord's work? And pastor starts thinking, maybe it's time for me to leave. And just like Israel in the wilderness, we can get frustrated and we can respond badly when we get into these situations.
And we tend to idealize the last thing we were doing in the church.
Yeah.
What did I ever leave that for this?
Yep.
If I could find another congregation, it must be better than this one.
Yep. So and so's in a really good situation, and we don't know all that goes on in the background of that. He might be ready to leave in 6 months as well. Yeah.
Been happening in that congregation.
That's right. Yeah. Well, how should we respond to frustrating situations? Moses and Aaron initially responded quite well back in chapter 20, verse 6. Moses and Aaron went from the assembly to the entrance to the tent of meeting, fell face down, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. The Lord said to Moses, "Take your staff, and you and your brother Aaron gather the assembly together, speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will pour out its water. You will bring water out of the rock for the community so that they and their livestock can drink." So Moses and Aaron respond quite well initially. They turn to God. And that normally is a very good thing to do. It helps to give us perspective in the midst of frustrating situations. And we're probably not going to get a vision of God's glory like Moses and Aaron did. We're probably not going to get a detailed list of instructions about what we should go out and do. But it can give us perspective. I like the story of Asaph in Psalm 73. Asaph looks at life and he's trying to figure out what God is saying and he's trying to make sense of what God is doing. And he says, you know, I looked at my life and I just have so many problems and life is always so difficult. I looked at the lives of the people around me, many of them very ungodly people. And everything seems to be going wonderful for them. What's the deal? And he said, I nearly slipped. I nearly said some things that I shouldn't have said. And if I'd have done that, I would have betrayed all of the people who looked up to me. But he said in Psalm 73, 16 and 17, when I tried to understand all of this, it was oppressive until I entered the sanctuary of God. Then I understood their final destiny. So in other words, until I went into the holy place and I got a fresh vision of God, and then all of a sudden, everything made sense to me again. And that can be a very good thing to do in the midst of frustrating circumstances. To ask questions like, you know, what is God like? What have I known God to do? What's His character? What might He be trying to do in this situation that I'm finding very frustrating? What's the spiritual way to respond rather than the natural human way to respond? Well, when we strike out in frustration, though, we dishonor God and we strike out. Now, I wish this story had a happy ending. It'd be great if we, you know, went out and everything turned out well, but it doesn't. After seeking God, Moses and Aaron went out and they did something really foolish. I think that this passage is told, Numbers 21 to 13, in such a way that it echoes Exodus 17, 1 to 7. And might be worth our going back to that. Exodus chapter 17. Verses 5 and 6. The Lord answered Moses, "Walk on ahead of the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, and water will come out of it for the people to drink." So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel. So we'll go back to Numbers 20, verse 8, and see what happens in this passage. The Lord said to Moses, "Take the staff, and you and your brother Aaron," very similar, "gather the assembly together, speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will pour out its water. You will bring water out of the rock for the community so that they and their livestock can drink." So Moses took the staff from the Lord's presence just as he commanded him. That's kind of a repeated refrain in the Pentateuch. Moses did exactly as the Lord commanded him. He and Aaron gathered the assembly together in front of the rock, and Moses said to them, "Listen, you rebels, must we bring you water out of this rock?" Then Moses raised his arm and struck the rock twice with his staff. Water gushed out, and the community and their livestock drank. Mission accomplished, right? Moses is the hero. He provides water for the congregation. Notice anything different between the two stories?
Yes. He was told to speak to the rock.
Speak to the rock. And he struck it.
Twice.
Yeah. It's kind of hard to get a real fix on exactly what Moses did that was so wrong. Obviously he didn't obey, so that's wrong. But, you know, To have the consequences come upon him that he did after all of his faithfulness, it's hard to get a fix on it. There's actually five passages in the Old Testament that talk about this. Verse 12 says, "Because you did not trust me enough to honor me as holy." Moses and Aaron didn't trust God. They didn't honor him as holy. Remember what? Kadesh. They're at this place called holy. And the fact that this passage begins and ends with that emphasis on holiness probably gives us a clue for what the story is about and what the sin is about. Mm-hmm. It's Moses and Aaron appear to be more concerned about how the people were viewing them than they were about how the people were viewing God. Holiness means to be set apart, to be different, to be distinct. And they seemed not to be concerned that God be treated as holy here. And it may be that we're not that concerned about God's holiness, but the Lord certainly is concerned about His holiness. Verse 24 puts it a little bit differently, same chapter. God tells Aaron he's going to die. "Aaron will be gathered to his people. He will not enter the land I give the Israelites, because both of you rebelled against my command at the waters of Meribah." It's interesting. What God does here is he picks up the word that Moses used to describe the people, and he applies it to Moses. Remember yesterday in Psalm 23, we said that there's a tendency among us as leaders to view ourselves as different from the sheep. when the reality is we're quite the same as the sheep. And God says, no, they're not the only rebels here. You and Aaron rebelled against me.
That's what he said about the people too. You rebelled.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, God picks up Moses' own words and throws it back on him.
Takes one to know one.
Yeah. Numbers 27:14, it puts the two together. It says, you disobeyed my command, or you rebelled against my command, to honor me as holy before their eyes.
Sorry, what verse was that?
27:14. Numbers 27:14. You disobeyed my command, or literally, you rebelled against my command, to honor me as holy before their eyes. Deuteronomy 32:51, Moses is reminded by God that he's not going to be allowed to enter the promised land. Moses wants that, just wants to be able to go into the land, and God says, no, don't bring it up again. And here in Deuteronomy, because you broke faith with me, or you were disloyal to me in the presence of the Israelites at the waters of Meribah Kadesh in the desert, and you did not uphold my holiness among the Israelites. And then Psalm 106, 32 and 33, it tends to put the focus on the people. So the psalm writer is feeling sorry for Moses, I think, a little bit. And he says, because Moses rebelled because of the people's rebellion, Moses spoke rash words. So in responding to this very frustrating situation, Moses began very well. He did what he should have done. He went to the Lord. He consulted him, he poured himself out before him. But then somewhere between leaving the tent of meeting and arriving at the rock, something happened in Moses' life. Something snapped. It may be that all of this frustration that's been boiling up over the last 40 years finally boiled over, and he snapped. And he did something really stupid. But one of the things that Numbers is trying to show is in the wilderness the people rebelled. In the wilderness, most of the leaders rebelled, and in the end, even Moses rebelled. And it's essential that our concern be to uphold the holiness of God, even we're in the midst of a really frustrating situation. That in that situation, we obey God, and we represent God well to people. But when we strike out in frustration, we strike out. We dishonor God. And I guess we've got to be honest that church provides us with a lot of opportunities to get frustrated, doesn't it? People in the pews get frustrated. I think sometimes as leaders we forget what it's like to be on the other side. But people in the pews get frustrated. Frustrated with leadership that's incompetent, that's unwise, that's uncaring, that's arrogant, that's sinful. Some people just get frustrated with change. It doesn't matter what the change is. It can be positive change. It can be negative change. They just don't like change. Others of us have just developed really bad habits of complaining and being negative. Leaders also get frustrated. We get frustrated with followers who lack faith, who are critical, who are sinful, who are unloving, who are ungracious, who are critical. And sinful followers can push leaders over the edge. We see that here in Numbers 20. I think that's what's going on. Is Moses has just had enough and he snaps. And I don't know what responding properly is going to look like for each one of you and for myself maybe. But I think that one of the general answers is found in 1 Peter 5. It's interesting that we were there last night. 1 Peter 5, verse 5. Middle of the verse, Peter says, all of you clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, because God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time, Cast all your anxiety on Him because He cares for you. God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. What does humility look like in a frustrating situation? The humble person realizes first and foremost that the important thing is not making me look good. The important thing is making God look good. The important thing is not what's on my agenda. The important thing is what's on God's agenda. And God is going to accomplish His purposes in His time and in His way. A humble person realizes that he or she is just as prone to failure as anyone else. I think it goes back to thinking again, you know, that the humble leader realizes I am a sheep in need of a shepherd just like anybody else. A humble person realizes that he has to seek God. Seek His resources through prayer. But when we strike out in frustration, we strike out and we dishonor God. It doesn't matter if we're a leader. It doesn't matter if we're a follower. The same thing's true. And those frustrating situations, those times in the wilderness, can be very difficult, but they can also be places where we can grow. We can either grow or we can fail in the wilderness. And I think the point of this story, again, is to remind us that our greatest concern should be the holiness of God. To treat Him as being uniquely special. It takes place at the place that's called Holy Kadesh, and it ends with the leader failing to give God that place of honor that He deserves. It's probably unrealistic to think that we're going to go through life, we're going to go through ministry, never failing. And this is one of the things I find quite amazing when I look at some of the Old Testament characters, is you look at what God didn't allow them to get away with, and what He seemingly allows us to get away with, and I just wonder what the real story is sometime. I mean, again, if you go back and you do that Moses did as the Lord command, follow that through, particularly the book of Exodus, Moses is always doing what God tells him to do. And this one occasion he doesn't, and he pays the price. No, that's probably where I'll leave it.